So Avery started talking about gravitational dynamics. So any questions about the stuff that he covered? I think he told me he talked about white dwarfs, neutron stars, spherical systems, and hydrostatic equilibrium, and also about action angle variables, which are important in dynamical systems. And not any questions? Of course, I mean, you can ask questions later as well. So today I'm going to finish talking about the spherical systems and also talk about, well, have basically more discussions about the spherical systems in general. So I'm going to start talking about isothermal sphere, and then I'm going to talk about Boltzmann equation and the static solutions to the Boltzmann equation. Okay. So let's start with the simplest. In fact, it might be the simplest problem, which is semi-realistic in gravitational dynamics, which is not really dynamical, it's a static problem, and that's singular isothermal sphere. Or actually, just more generally, it's just isothermal sphere. So isothermal sphere is a very simple problem and something you would think might occur often in astrophysics, but in fact, it's really a toy model. And that's assuming that you have a system that's bound gravitationally and it's in thermal equilibrium. So the equation you have to solve is Laplacian of phi. Of course, this is Poisson equation. And if you are in thermal equilibrium, this density is related to potential. In what way? Anybody can guess? If you have thermal equilibrium, how does density related to potential? And the hint is that it comes with the name Boltzmann. So the Boltzmann appears in different places. So, but Boltzmann is. Okay, and what is the Boltzmann distribution?
It's something with an exponential.
Good, good. That's what I was looking for, yes. So a Boltzmann distribution is exponential, which has temperature in it. And let me see, so it's something like rho naught times e to the minus m phi divided by kt, where m is the mass of the particle, phi is the gravitational potential, and KTK is the Boltzmann constant, T is the temperature, right? So this is just in your little,
yeah,
to explain it to you.
I was just like, M of P, like when you write NP, it always looks like mass of a proton.
Well, it could be mass of a proton, but yeah, so I don't have a better, I think I call it MP because so mass of a particle. Right, sorry about that. This is my particle mass. So this is a Boltzmann distribution, right? So if whenever you have a distribution which is in thermal equilibrium, then it goes as exponential. The density goes as exponential of minus energy divided by kT. And
rho zero
is a normalization. In this case, would be the density where phi is zero, basically. So it's just a normalization, really. Maybe I shouldn't call it rho zero. I guess it could be density at infinity if there was an infinity there. But wherever phi is zero, that would be it. So you can actually solve this, and this might not be the easiest way to solve this, but I'm not going to go through the details of doing the solution. Hi, Michael. So what you find is if you solve this, there is an easy way to show the solution. In general, so this is a second order differential equation, so there might be multiple solutions, but in fact, if you plot it in terms of the variables I'm going to write here, it's just going to be one solution. And so here, the horizontal axis is rho times r cubed divided by m, divided by m, right? Where m is the mass, right? M of r. So m of r is just integral from 0 to r of rho of r d cubed r. And this axis is something that's, let me just write it down, g mp m of r divided by r times kt. Okay. So these are both dimensionless, right? So this is something like the ratio of real energy or gravitational energy of particles divided by the temperature, thermal kT, which is the typical thermal energy. And this is just rho r cubed divided by m. That would be, this is also dimensionless because this is dimension mass divided by mass.
Okay, so if mp is the mass of the particle, then mr is
the
mass of what?
The total mass enclosed within the radius. So here we're thinking about the gas of particles of mass mp in thermal equilibrium. So here, assuming a spherical symmetry, that hence the name isothermal sphere. Good. And if you actually, you can solve this equation, and it turns out that this would be just one curve in this plane, and it kind of looks like this. Right. It kind of keeps spiraling in. There would be a fixed point here. This would be 3. This would be like 1.5. This would be 2. So these are dimensionless numbers. And the other thing is that interestingly, so this would be just one curve. And you can relate this to the total energy of the system. Get another color here. So if you use virial theorem, and I'm not going to derive this for you, but if you use just virial theorem, you could show that this quantity, lambda, which is r times e divided by g m squared, is just the line in this is just the line in this plane. So this would be constant line lambda. Use a different color here. So this would be a constant lambda lines.
E
is the total energy of the system. And right, so I guess I have everything here. Sorry, this is 1, it's not 1.5. And
I'm sorry, I'm going to ask again. But
sure.
M stands for what?
M is the total mass enclosed within radius r.
The M of r?
That's right. I can put it there. Okay. And I think I've made a mistake in this plot. These are not at the same points. Let me just do this more correctly. So this is 1 here. And then there is a point here, which is 1.5, where these lines emanate from. So these are constant lambda. This would be 1.5.
Should the exponent on E be unitless?
Be what?
Should the exponent on
E? Isn't it?
Doesn't it have units of energy?
But this is energy. KT is also energy. Because m phi is a gravitational potential energy, right? Because phi is the Newtonian potential.
Yeah.
So m times that is the potential energy.
Oh. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good. So, right. So there are these two pieces of information that all the solutions look like this. But then if you want to calculate what is the total energy of each solution at any point here, is so basically, so this is the core. You start from zero radius and you go out. You know, this 3 is constant density, and you can just easily show you just m is 4 pi over 3 times. Let's see. So actually, this is almost 3, not exactly 3, but let's see. So if you have a constant density, this would be just a number, right? So it would be rho times r cubed. divided by 4 over 3 pi r cubed. So this would be something like, right, so this would be 3 over 4 pi.
Yeah, you're missing a row.
All right, so there's a row. Sorry, there's a row in the denominator. So I'm, I might be plotting the inverse of this. I have to look this up. Okay, so now I'm a bit confused, but this is I think it might be the inverse of this. But I don't have, let me see. Yeah, so this should be 4 pi over 3. That's not 3 over 4 pi. So let me look this up. I don't quite remember. It might be the inverse of this. I might be missing this somewhere. Anyway, so this would be just a number. And for a core. And it turns out that when you solve it, then you find a trajectory here. But if you calculate the total energy, then am I doing this right? Yeah. When you calculate the total energy, then you get these lines. These lines of total energy from the Virial theorem. And so the core would be here. And as you go to a smaller, larger radii, then this basically the total energy changes. And it turns out that at some point, there is no solution, basically. For a given value of mass and energy, there is no intersection between the lines of constant energy and or a constant lambda, which is this ratio of energy divided by gm squared over r. This is a small r, sorry. And the actual solution, which implies lambda basically should be bigger than this lambda c, or this guy basically should be bigger than this lambda c, which is minus 0.33, roughly speaking. And if it's a smaller, then there is no solution basically with that energy. Does this make sense? So
lambda c is the one that is tangent.
That's exactly. Lambda c is tangent to this curve. So this would be lambda c. I'm not plotting this very well, but this would be lambda c. Right. So what does it mean? It means that let's say if you start with a smaller sphere, so this is box, assuming that you put that as a term on a sphere within the box. If you start with a smaller sphere, then you do have a solution, and you keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger, right? Then at some point, you realize that basically there is no solution, there is no isothermal solution that can be put inside the other sphere. So your solution runs out. And that's known as that, so that basically means that you don't. If you cannot have a large enough system that is in isothermal equilibrium with gravity. And this is known as Jeans instability. And what happens is if you actually try to put, try to have basically start with a value of lambda. Because I mean, these are numbers that are fixed in the initial condition. Mass is the total mass of the system, and energy is the total energy of the system. But if you basically put system in a spherical box with ratios of Re divided by GMS squared, and R is the size of your box, okay. If you try to put system with values that are smaller than this critical value, then it cannot actually find a smooth isothermal solution, and such solution doesn't exist. There is a solution that does exist, is known as a singular isothermal solution, and that would be if you do reach a isothermal equilibrium or a thermal equilibrium, you get those. So basically, the idea would be that if you look at rho of r versus r, at high temperatures you get something that looks smooth, right? So it would be basically something as smooth. It's like in this room, your gravity is not important. So you just have uniform distribution, right? So now, if you try to lower and lower temperature in this room, now this room isn't quite spherical, but basically what happens is that the self-gravity becomes more and more important, so the density would be more and more concentrated, right? So I'm normalizing it to some value at the boundary of the box. So this is rho divided by rho of R naught, let's say. This is, would be R naught. It's the size of the box. So it gets more and more concentrated. At some point, you cross this threshold. Basically, if your temperature is small enough, you cross that threshold. And what happens is you basically don't have any smooth solution. The only solution that exists would be a singular one. And that's known as a singular, as a term. Singular isothermal sphere. Of course, in reality, this is an unstable situation, so it does it doesn't have to remain
it's
spherical. It's supposed to go to infinity as it goes as r to the minus 2 here. Right. And you can get that from simple scaling argument. If you try to find a scaling solution for this equation, then you get that r to the minus 2. So for singular as a thermal sphere, let me just see that I've got everything here. For singular as a thermal sphere, you have rho of r going as r to the minus 2. M of r, of course, you integrate this, going as r. So mass is finite. Most of the mass is in the outer skirts, but the density is biggest at the center. And the potential, interestingly, it's logarithmic, right? Which is like, you might expect that because, I mean, you can see this. This is the power law, but potential is here in the exponent. So actually, get the power law, phi would be, but phi would go as log of rho, which would be logarithmic. Right. And the rate of instability would be basically a typical so-called Jeans instability rate. That would be omega j is, roughly speaking, a square root of 4 pi g rho. So, but I mean, this singular isothermal sphere is really a toy model that you should have in mind. I mean, in reality, if you have a system which is below this threshold, if the temperature is low enough, then you're not going to have a singular sphere. You're going to basically, the system is going to collapse to form basically a small halos. And the size of those halos basically would be given by criteria like this. This is a so-called virial theorem in some sense. So the individual halos that are formed, they would be stable under this criterion, but the whole system, you're not going to find one equilibrium solution for it. That's the main thing, is that the thermal, this thermal equilibrium is not something, you're not going to achieve that at low temperatures. At high enough temperatures, you can have systems that are reasonable thermal equilibrium, like the gas in this room. But if you go to low enough temperature that you could find, basically, you go to this Jeans instability regime, then you're not really talking about thermal equilibrium anymore.
So, I'm a bit lost.
Sure.
This is a model for what?
So, this is a toy model, right? It's not a model for anything physical at this level. It just says that if you have a bunch of particles that are in thermal equilibrium, the same way that you define thermal equilibrium in statistical mechanics, then what would be their distribution? If there's gravity and they are in thermal equilibrium, what would be their distribution? Okay, good, good. That's a good question. So strictly speaking, no astrophysical object is close to this. And we're going to discuss that shortly after in a little bit. The time scale to reach thermal equilibrium for most astrophysical objects is very, very long. The only exception is our blue ball clusters, because the number of particles in them is not very big. And it turns out that the larger the number of particles, the longer it is for gravitational systems to reach thermal equilibrium, right? You could have, like, you can think of a star, for example, but the stars aren't in constant temperature.
Yeah, that's why it's hard for me.
Exactly. That's a, so you need something that is in constant temperature. So a star has a heat source at the center, and so there would be a temperature gradient. So that would have been the right model for this. But I guess another system that people think about are molecular clouds that don't have a heat source in the middle. So so they would be like proto stars. So they would reach a constant temperature.
So yeah, but it's like a gas giant that doesn't
have. Well, not quite a gas giant. I mean, by giant, do you mean a star or a?
No, like a Jupiter that doesn't have any. Like, because we also.
Well, so the thing with Jupiter is it's degenerate gas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there aren't that many places. So I think Avery discussed degenerate gases. So, like Earth or Jupiter, they are kind of degenerate in the middle because the degeneracy pressure is bigger than thermal pressure.
So you mentioned that protostar.
So this is a star in the process of formation of a star before the nuclear fusion happens at the center. Then it would be a protostar. It would be So there would be a time where something isn't quite a star yet, but it's kind of looks kind of a spherical, so it's kind of collapsing and losing energy due to thermal radiation. So there aren't really that many systems that are like this. So basically, whenever you do have a core, and it's kind of a temperature, then this region describes it more or less. But then basically what this tells you is that you cannot have very big cores in gravitational systems. Because for a given temperature, at least, you cannot have very big core, and the size is essentially given by this formula, right? This form, if the energy becomes too negative, then or if the cores are too concentrated, then they would become unstable. Right? They cannot become too concentrated. That's the point. Okay, let's see. Right, I have to look up what's happening with this. I think I might have a inverse power. I'm a bit confused why I have this like (3/4π/3). I think that's a power minus one. But look, I'm going to look this up and let you know. So let's see. So I talked about singular isothermal sphere. So an interesting example of this is core collapse in global clusters. Over our clusters. So I think Avery had mentioned this, and I'm going to derive this later for you guys, that the time scale for gravitational collisions to lead to thermal equilibrium goes as the dynamical time scale times n divided by log of n, where n is the number of objects, the number of particles in the system. So you can imagine that if you have a system with lots of particles in it, and for example, if you count the number of dark matter particles in the Milky Way halo, does anybody know how many dark matter particles are in? So let's say, so the mass of the Milky Way halo is 10 to the 15 solar mass, 10 to the 12 solar mass. And a dark matter particle is like 100 times the mass of a proton. And what is the mass of a proton? 10 to the minus 27 kilograms, which is 10 to the minus 24 grams, which is, there's 24 orders of magnitude there. From a proton to a solar mass, that's 33 orders of magnitude, I guess. So I don't know, it's like 10 to the 70, 80 particles. It's a huge number. So this number is going to be huge, even by astronomical standards. So dark matter particles never reach, in a halo, can never reach thermal equilibrium within a Hubble time. But then there are systems that can do that through gravitational interactions, like a global cluster. This dynamical time scale, this has like a million particles in it. The dynamical time scale is something of order, let's say, 100,000 years, so 10 to the 5. So this number is barely of order Hubble time, right? Because it's 10 to the 5 years, this is 10 to the 6, so it would be 10 to the 11 years divided by log of 10, let's say. So this would be something of order the Hubble time, which is 10 to the 10 years. And so those are systems that could actually reach thermal equilibrium. So gravitational collisions between different stars could be enough to reach thermalize the system. And so what you find is that you can actually calculate this, and for some global clusters, you actually see a core. So I have some pictures in the lecture notes. I have to reproduce them by hand. So if you look at log of density versus log of R, for some of these, they just flatten. And then for others, they just look like 1 over R squared. So this is known as core collapse. And the idea is that if you just have a cluster of stars and just look at them long enough, sit and look at basic gravitational evolution, at some point, they try to reach thermal equilibrium, but of course, the global cluster doesn't have a finite size because it's an infinite space. So this number is always, of course, energy of a gravitational bound system is negative, mass is finite, but R is basically big because you don't have any box. So this number is arbitrarily negative. So it can actually never reach thermal equilibrium. So the thermal equilibrium would be singular, but of course, it doesn't start from thermal equilibrium. It starts from some arbitrary distribution. It has to reach thermal equilibrium. And you can calculate for basically how long it takes for different systems. The system, the numbers show that if you work out the numbers, the ones that are like this are the ones that haven't had time to reach thermal equilibrium. This is longer than Hubble time. The ones that look like this, these are the ones that have already reached thermal equilibrium. The time is shorter than the Hubble time. Good. So that's interesting. That's one example where this calculation can be seen easily. It turns out that this singular isothermal distribution is never really a very good description of any system or a very good approximation, but it happens to be close to what you find in many places in systems. So dark matter halos kind of look like this. Global clusters, some of them kind of look like this. And the centers of the stars, not quite. They're more like the core. So the core systems, this might be a good approximation. And there are some systems where the singular isothermal, at least for part of them, is a good approximation. So let's see. In actual global clusters, though, so the density never exactly goes to infinity. Can you tell why? So what prevents the density from becoming infinite at center of a global cluster?
Non-thermal stuff.
Okay.
Very well, I guess.
So let me ask you one thing. So do you think this is a good approximation for a discrete distribution of the stars? I mean, can a discrete distribution of the stars be a spherical?
No.
Okay, so that's the answer. So we assume it's a spherical distribution, but of course, if you're talking about discrete stars, they wouldn't be spherical, right? Because they're discrete. So the discreteness effects actually prevents this from being exact. So that's also the same thing that can lead to gravitational interactions and lead to thermal effects. But also the discreteness prevents this from being an exact description. Yes.
Why can't they be spherical?
Because if you have two spheres, they're not the spheres, right? It doesn't have a spherical symmetry, right? Unless they are on top of each other, but then that wouldn't be two stars. That would be just one star, right? So if you're thinking, so this would be just a coarse grain description of the system. You can never have exact a static distribution of a bunch of discrete stars. They would always be moving around. So, and On average, you could assume it might be some average density, but that's an approximation that you're making, right? It's never exact. So in reality, the keywords that happens is the so-called binaries. And so what you form is, what happens when you have core collapse, then you form binaries, and those binaries effectively soften the core. So they prevent infinite density. That would be the size of the size of binary stars, right? And that's basically the art, and then the artifact of its discreteness. Discreteness prevents, gives the particles a finite size effectively. They're called hard binaries. Okay, so good. So that's the story of isothermal spheres. So my next topic is basically the collisionless Boltzmann equation, which I think I haven't has Avery or I talked about Boltzmann equation ever? Nope. Okay, so good. So that's going to be a new topic then. So collisionless Boltzmann equation. Okay, but before I go on, any questions about these isothermal spheres? So as I said, this is a toy model, but and it's never a very good approximation for any system in astrophysics. But it's something that in some situations you have to basically use your judgment and see whether this gives you a good criterion for what's happening and what's not happening. And basically, this is the main thing that. This is basically the same idea as the Jeans instability, that if some system is too big, then it cannot remain at thermal equilibrium. It has to collapse basically until this equation, this inequality is satisfied. Right. And I think one last thing I forgot to say is that this is assuming it's a spherical, but if it's rotating, and I just put this as a side note, for a rotating sphere, basically what happens is that it doesn't remain spherical, but you can easily estimate the amount of asphericity to have equilibrium. This would be something like 15 omega squared divided by 8 pi g rho, which is roughly omega squared divided by omega j squared. Okay. So this is the eccentricity of a rotating sphere. If it rotates too fast, and so you have to compare rotation rate with the Jeans instability rate, which is what I wrote up there. If it rotates, rotation is slow enough compared to this value, then it's almost a spherical. But if it becomes fast enough compared to that, then you don't really have a spherical system anymore. Okay. If there's no questions, then let me move on to the next area. So this is a system that you can think of it as a fluid. Right, because the only thing that matters here is density. And isothermal sphere, I mean, we're going to discuss it in more details, but it's a fluid description is a good description. Gravitational systems, though, they're not generally described as a fluid. And by that, I mean, so the fluid, what are the important properties of a fluid? What would you say? If you think of a fluid, what do you think of? Pressure, what else? Pressure, velocity, good. That's the thing about the fluid. That fluid, you would think that there's a finite number of numbers at any point. Pressure, velocity, density. That's enough to describe the properties of a fluid. Temperature, maybe. However, a gravitational system, specifically collisionless gravitational systems, or if the collisions aren't significant, at every point, you just knowing a few numbers is not enough. You could have an entire distribution of velocities. And there's nothing that tells you that it must be anything simple. It doesn't have to be Boltzmann like that. It doesn't have to be Maxwellian. It could be anything. So a few numbers per every point is not enough. You actually have to deal with the whole distribution, which is the phase space density, right? And this could be a function of time as well. Of course, I mean, even this may not be a good description. I mean, it doesn't have to be. By that, I mean, it doesn't have to be a continuous function. For example, for a bunch of stars, this is sum of delta function. So even thinking of it as a continuous function might be an approximation. But still, that's a better approximation than a fluid approximation. So if you're dealing with this whole full thing, which is a six-dimensional function, or like a seven-dimensional function, if you include time, instead of a three-dimensional function, then you have a different ballgame. So you're not thinking about solving partial differential equations in 3D space. You're thinking about solving partial differential equations in a six-dimensional space. And the equation you would solve is known as the collisionless Boltzmann equation, which is just saying that df by dt, which is equal to partial f by partial t plus velocity dot partial f by partial x plus, or I guess minus gradient of phi dot partial f by partial v is equal to what? So this is a so-called co-moving derivative, right? Because df by dt is basically if you move with a particle, how does the phasor space density change? So this is the partial time derivative respect to time, and this is basically x dot, and this is v dot, right? From a gravitational system. V dot is minus grad phi, and v is just x dot. So this would be just df by dt as you move with the particle. And this would be what? Anybody? What should it be? Evolution in the phase space. So the volume in the phase space is, does it change with time or not? No. So then how should the density in the phase space density change? The volume doesn't change, and the number of particles doesn't change.
Zero.
Good. So if the number of particles doesn't change and the volume doesn't change, then density doesn't change. So this should be zero. So that's the statement of collisionless. And in fact, if it's collisional, then this would change, right? Because you don't have the conservation of phase space volume anymore. Because particles can randomly jump from one point to another. So in that case, I mean, there is no continuous evolution in the same sense. So then there could be collisional terms that happen here. But in general, this is true if there are no collisions, and that's just a statement of Liouville's theorem, right? Good. So you have to just solve this equation, which looks kind of simple, but it's not really, right? Because it's a six-dimensional or seven-dimensional partial differential equation. And in fact, it's a non-local, it's an integral differential equation. Can you tell me why it's an integral differential equation? There is an integral hidden here. Do you know where it is? Right, exactly. So phi is an integral in terms of f, right? Because phi is something like minus g integral d3r, let's say if this is phi of r, this would be dr prime, rho of r prime, divided by r minus r prime. And rho is an integral over f, right? Sorry, this is phi. So rho of r is integral of f times d3, f of r and v, d3v. I guess if this is just density in the phasor space, then that would be the definition of density in real space. So you have to integrate over all velocities to get the density. So this is an integral differential equation. It's not a very easy equation to solve, but this is the equation that you have. It looks kind of simple. And right, I think to be consistent with my convention, I have to put an MP here as well, because I think in my notes, so this is the number density in the phase space. There would be an MP here. Okay. So you can work with the moments of this equation, right? And that would actually get you close to the fluid description. Thank you. See you guys. See you. So let's see. So in fact, as I said, you could actually use this. There is a similar equation if you have collisions. And you can go from start from here and get to the fluid equations. I'm not going to. Actually, I'm going to tell you how that's going to happen. But as I said, in general, you don't have a fluid description. So this equation would be true in general for particles as well, but then there would be extra terms on the right-hand side if you have collision. So the moments of this equation give you things that you are more familiar with, like the continuity equation and Euler equation. So if I define n as basically, so the moments would be things like n of x, which is number density. It would be just the same as that rho divided by mp. Or integral of f d3v. You could define the velocity at every point, which is basically the average of velocities, 1 over n integral of f v d3v. And then there is, so this is the mean velocity. And then what else? So we can define also a stress tensor, but let me just write it. Should I write the stress tensor? Yeah, so there's a Tij also, which is also a function of x, which is 1 over n integral of f vi vj dgv. Okay. And so with these definitions, you basically can multiply this Boltzmann equation with arbitrary powers of v, and then integrate them over v. And then that gets you to equations that are more familiar. For example, what you get is if you just do one integral over v, so first moment, or sorry, don't multiply by any v, just integrate over v, first moment, it gives you dn by dt plus divergence of n times u equals 0. So this is known as what? You recognize this equation? Continuity equation, good. Do I write this? Does it have 2u? No, it says it's not 2u, it's ui. So continuity equation. So if I multiply this by 1v and then integrate it, then so then on the right, I have integral of n times u. Sorry, I have d by dt of n times u. Right? So all I'm doing is I just multiply this equation by v. So the v, of course, goes inside because v is independent of t. So here the idea is that r or x and v and t are independent variables. So if I multiply this by v and then bring the v inside, I can basically v can get inside d by dt. V can get inside d by dx. V cannot get inside d by dv. It doesn't commute with that. So I have to do some integration by parts. And what I get is something that looks like this. Let me see. Do, 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 do. I get n times d by dt plus u dot grad u. Is minus n times grad phi minus divergence of, or let me just write it in some way that does make sense. Right, so where did I put this? Okay, so let me just write this now. Di n. Sigma I j squared. So this I, I guess I can put the I index everywhere here. There's an I here, there would be an I here. So I guess this would be j. And this sigma I j squared is, so Tij would be, Tij would be n ui uj plus sigma, so let me just put this like this. So. Sigma ij. So,
so we're doing this to solve the main equation?
This is kind of, this is a, let's see. So this is the equivalent way of writing this equation. But in a sense, it's like a Boltz, I'm trying to say, it's like a Taylor expansion in a sense, right? In the velocity space. So this is only the first moment, this is the second moment, and you have an arbitrary number of moments. They're never actually decoupled from each other. So if you want to solve them consistently, which is equivalent to solving this equation, is you have to solve all these infinite number of equations together. The advantage is that these are not six-dimensional variables, they are three-dimensional variables, right? Because this is just a function of x and t, u is just a function of x and t, this tij or sigma ij is just a function of x and t, but then there are infinite number of these equations. Now what happens is that in some situations you can truncate this. For example, if you have a perfect fluid, so let me actually write down this equation. Do you know what this is called? This equation? Yeah, the second one. Right. Do you recognize this form anywhere? Must have seen it somewhere, right? It has grad phi in it. It has d by dt plus u dot grad u in it. Right. So this is... this is the Euler equation for the fluid, Euler or Jeans equation. Just use a different color. Or Jeans equation. So let me actually do this more explicitly. So what's the point here? So the point is you're multiplying that Boltzmann equation by V, let's say, and then you're integrating it. So the second term is just VI DF, VJ, let's say, DF by DXJ, and multiply this by VI. And the last term is you have minus grad phi, let's say DJ phi, df by dvj, and I multiply this by vi. All I've done here is multiplying by vi. This vi could be upstairs. And now I'm integrating over vi. Right? So what I get is d by dt. This guy, integral of fv d3v, by definition is just nu. Nui. This guy, I can bring v's inside, right? Because v and x are independent variables. So it becomes just d by dxj of this combination of basically fvi vj, which I defined as tij, So it's just n times tij, right? And then there is this last guy. It looks kind of complicated. If I integrate over v, so I can do an integration by parts, right? If I integrate over v. So this is independent of v, right? So it's like a, for v integral, this is just like a constant. It just depends on x. So if I do an integration by part, then it becomes a plus, right? So all I'm doing is I'm doing an integral d3v here, right? I get plus d by dvj of dvi is delta ij, right? So it's delta ij times dj is just the I phi. And then I have integral of f d3v, which is n. So this is that question. Okay. So it's not, it's basically that thing. And if I just use that definition for Tij in terms of sigma ij, then all I get is, let's see. So n dot I already have from the continuity equation is minus, am I doing this right? Yep. So from the continuity equation, I have minus divergence of nu times ui plus n times ui dot, or d partial ui by partial t. This guy, I can plug in terms of this definition up there, right? So there is d by dxj of n ui uj plus sigma ij, right? And then there's the I of phi n equals to zero. Okay? So there will be some cancellations, right? Can you see where the cancellation happens? I mean, there's this term with a minus sign, and then this acting on these guys, right? So this, there would be, I can write this as derivative as this acting on this guy times this, plus this guy acting on this guy times these two guys. I have to just use Siebisch fun actually repeat cancel this guy. So I need a divergence, so I need to d by dxj needs to contract with n times uj, so that would be the divergence, right? So then what, so this would be canceling that guy, so what would be left is just n uj, right, times divergence of, sorry, times d by dxj of ui. The other term would be canceling that. And then there's n partial ui by partial t. And there will be d by dxj or dj of n sigma ij plus n di phi. Call this zero. And this is the same equation as I have. I mean, these two terms are that guy first, and the guys on the left-hand side. And these two are the guys on the left. So the interesting thing about this, of course, is that this is the acceleration, right? This is n times the acceleration. So what this is really telling you is what you've heard, you've seen, I mean, in ordinary fluid mechanics is the acceleration, which is that term. Acceleration, which is d by dt. So this is partial by partial t plus x dot times gradient is just, this is du by dt. This acceleration is just, this term, the n's cancel, so this is just a gravitational acceleration. And this term is all the non-gravitational forces, basically. So this is the pressure, or anisotropic pressure, it could be. Right? So this is just the second, Newton's second law for a fluid. OK? Okay. Well, for any distribution, it doesn't have to be a fluid. So when we talk about fluids, so does this make sense? All right. So and you could do this with higher for higher moments as well. Of course, this is not doesn't really change the nature of this equation because you connect the first moment to the second. Sorry, the zeroth moment basically. I could have called this the zeroth moment. I don't know whatever it is the. I don't actually know what is the correct. I guess I should probably call this the zeroth moment, actually, right? Because I'm not multiplying by. Do they call, are these called first moment or zeroth moment?
If you,
zeroth? Yeah, okay, good. And this would be the first moment, right? This would be the first moment of the equation. This would be the zeroth moment of, because I'm not multiplying by any velocity. But the thing is, the first moment of density, the evolution of the first moment, or sorry, evolution of the zeroth moment, which is this n guy, is related to the first moment. The evolution of the first moment, which is u, is related to the second moment, which is this tij, and so on. So this is never actually closes in any practical way, unless you find a way to close this. And the fluid approximation, or the perfect fluid approximation, is kind of okay. So perfect fluid. So for a perfect fluid is when this sigma ij, which is essentially the moments of the velocity distribution, right? So notice, I mean, I have this Tij, which was the second moment, right, the second moment, I've actually split it in two different parts. And the idea would be that this is just the part due to motion of the system. But if you go to the rest frame, there would be a Tij that is the sigma ij. So the sigma ij is the intrinsic velocity dispersion, or n times sigma ij is the intrinsic velocity dispersion in the rest frame of the system.
It's not related of how it rotates.
The sigma, you mean?
It's not related to the shear.
No, sigma ij is not the shear. So sigma ij is just the velocity, is the intrinsic velocity dispersion. So if you go to the rest frame. Yeah, so the rotation, you need to get a, take a curl of the velocity. So it depends on curl. This guy, what do you call this thing? What do you call this?
Curl.
Curl, yeah. You call it curl, right?
In English.
In English, okay. But I guess you call it rotation, or is it in French?
Rotation.
What is that?
Rotation.
Rotation, okay, right. So I remember when I was a kid, I had some books that called it rotation. But yeah, so that's, so the point is that to rotation, you need the spatial gradients. So this is a this thing is defined locally, right? So at every point, and some people define shear, use sigma to define shear as well. So that could be a confusing notation in principle. But these guys are defined locally. But then if you want to define rotation, you want to see how velocity changes from one point to the next. And that would be something like gradient curl of u. That would be like a rotation. You could define this. Or you could do basically omega ij would be like di uj minus dj ui. Right, so those things could come in. The fluid approximation or the perfect fluid approximation is when you have basically you could assume that this guy, which is a tensor, sigma ij, it's just one number, which is diagonal, or sorry, proportional to the identity. And then this would be known as the pressure. Okay? So this would be the perfect fluid approximation. And for collisionless systems, there is no reason for this to be valid unless it happens to be the case. Like in a homogeneous universe, for example, symmetry tells you that this should be the case. For example, in cosmology, that would be the right thing to do, just by symmetry. But there is no process that forces this to be the case. In a collisional system, in fact, there would be some collisional terms here, But it turns out that if your collisions conserve energy, conserve the number of particles and conserve energy and momentum, I guess in this case the conserve momentum, these two equations would still be valid because basically the collision terms, these integrals over them would be zero because they conserve number and conserve momentum. And so you still get these two equations, but then what collisions do for you is that they could isotropize the system very quickly. So this doesn't have to be. So then this could become basically isotropic. There is a process that could keep it, even in a dynamical system, to be isotropic. And that would be the case of a perfect fluid. In general, that wouldn't be the case for a collisionless system. So there would be terms that go as something like lambda c. I shouldn't call it lambda c because I had one there. They call it, let's call it lambda f. Something like a mean free path times times collisional terms or times viscous terms. Or let me just call it things that go as gradient of velocity. Let me just call it divj, diuj. And these guys would be the so-called viscous terms. Right. So the idea is that if this lambda f is a small, if the collisions happen very, very fast in a collisional system, which is that wouldn't be these gravitational systems, then it could isotropize very fast. So you just have an isotropic velocity dispersion at any point. Of course, this pressure could be different at different points, but there would be isotropic. And then if you want to go to the second order, then the fact that there's a finite distance between collisions tells you that there would be some anisotropy in this velocity dispersion because basically you're not completely local. You see the fact that there's a velocity gradient from one point to another, right? So you cannot locally see what the velocity field is, and that's, that comes in. But then the limit of perfect fluid, these corrections go to zero. So in the case of lambda f going to infinity, which is a collisionless system, so this lambda f is a mean free path of particles. Then you have a collisionless system, and which is not a fluid. So this would be collisionless. So lambda f going to zero is a fluid or a perfect fluid. This going to infinity is a collisionless system, like a gravitational system. Okay, and as I said, P is just the pressure, but the definition of pressure. There might be an MP here I think there's probably an MP here if you want to do this, related to actual pressure, right? Because in the Euler equation, there's a mass density that happens here, sits here. So you have to multiply these by MP to get mass density. And right. And then this would be the gradient of pressure in Euler equation. Yeah. OK. Good. Any questions? Right. So this is how fluid equations come about in general for general systems. And they could equally apply for gravitational and non-gravitational system. For gravitational system, though, this idea of collisions is kind of moot because, I mean, unless you have non-gravitational collisions that do this job for you. Okay, so now that I've introduced the idea of Boltzmann equation, let me just see what is it. So let's see what we can do with it. So this Boltzmann equation is incredibly important because essentially, as I said, all gravitational systems, the systems that they're basically tenuous enough, where non-gravitational interactions aren't important, like the systems of a halo, for example, halo of dark matter, or a galaxy, a spherical or elliptical galaxy, or a spiral galaxy, or so when you're talking about the stars or you're talking about dark matter particles, I guess these are the two main places that this is important. You can assume that they're almost collisionless. The stars rarely collide with each other, and dark matter particles, we know, they're almost collisionless. This is the equation you have to solve. So to do that, we can start from the simplest question, simplest possible solutions, and those would be static solutions. So the static solutions of static solutions. So it turns out that there are quite, even static solutions, when you put partial f by partial t equal to zero, there are quite a lot of, there could be quite a lot of solutions because it's still, it's a six-dimensional function and it's a partial differential equation, and this is still an integral differential equation as we discussed. But there's a simple way of thinking about the spherical solution that turns out is the most general solutions. Sorry, not a spherical, a static solutions. And that's the fact that something that can be easily shown, phase space density, if partial f is partial t, if partial f by partial t equal to zero, then you could show that f is just a function of integrals of motion, or II's, where I's are integrals of motion. That means dI by dt is equal to zero. Integrals of motion. So what's an example of an integral of motion that remains conserved along trajectories in a static potential? You have a static potential. For a free particle. Just think of a free particle that's moving on a trajectory. So what is it that conserved for it? Momentum. No, momentum is not conserved. If you have a potential, energy is conserved, right? If you have a static potential, this is a static system, right? We're talking about static system. Energy is an integral of motion. What is another example? Let's say if you have a spherical symmetry, angular momentum, right? So energy is the most general. So all the systems that are static that have at least energy as a concern. Right? Angular momentum or angular momentum in Z direction. So these would be a special cases, right? That if you have axis symmetry or if you have a spherical symmetry, then you have dependence on these as well. You could have dependence on these as well. But and then there could be other integrals of motion. For an integrable system, how many integrals of motion are there? Anybody? As many as equations? Yeah. Like how many equations are there? Like you have in three dimensions, how many equations are there? There could be three or six, I guess, based on your definition. So I'm just wondering, is it three or six? So Avery discussed this action and angle variables, right? Yeah. Okay. So how many of them are there in three dimensions?
Many angles.
Do you remember? Yeah. How many? So what are the action and angle variables? Do you remember that? What are action and angle variables?
Well, the action and angle variables, they are the integrals of the system. They're the integrals of the motion.
Uh-huh. Are both action and angle variables are integrals of the motion?
Oh, wait, no.
Action is, right. So, good. So remember the action and angle variables are just a particular form of canonical transformation of the phase space where basically your momenta become constants, right? And the constants of motion, but in a sense that your Hamiltonian only depends on the momenta, that don't depend on the position. So your positions would advance uniformly because remember if you have x dot, it goes as dh by dp. P dot is minus dh by dx. So if there is no dx by dx, if you have a set of coordinates in which h depends only on p, this is 0, just a function of p. So your p's are constants, and x's just move uniformly with time. And so the idea is that an integrable system is a system where you can always do a transformation where this happens. Right? You can always go to a coordinate system where p's are constants and x's move uniformly, and h is just a function of p's. And in that coordinate, and those p's are called action variables. X's would be called the angle variables. Three, right, good. So if you have three-dimensional system, the phase space is, so there will be three positions and three momenta, right? So so you would have three. Right, so the integrable system has three of these guys in general, right? So for example, in a spherical system, these three are conserved, right? E, L, and L, Z are conserved. But these are not, yeah, so this would be an example of the, and a spherical system is an integrable system.
So wouldn't there be four in a...
Sorry, what is that?
Wouldn't there be four in a spherical system? Like you'd have your three angular momenta.
Right, so that's true. So yes, there's Lx, Ly, and Lz for a spherical system. So a spherical system is a little bit funny because it's in a sense, it's called, it's degenerate because there are four of these, there are more of these conserved guys. And it turns out they're not independent of each other in the sense that if you do a canonical transformation, you do get more of those, but I'm trying to find the right.
Well, I guess in spherical symmetry, like you can always reduce it motion to a plane.
Right.
And then.
Right. So in a plane, then that makes so you have just one angular momentum and one energy.
Yeah.
Right. So that you could do that. So I mean, you can imagine. I mean, if you have a three-dimensional system, you cannot have four momenta. So it seems that you have more conserved variables, but it's not that you have more independent momenta. So that you could relate them to each other in a sense. You have the fourth one to the three that are conserved. But I mean, the main idea is that you have to find a canonical transformation to go from your old momenta to new momenta, and there should be three independent ones, and not more than that. So let's see. So this is.
Mm-hmm. And some of the components of angular momentum.
Yeah, right. So if you have an axis symmetric system, then these are the three things. Well, I guess if we have axis symmetric system, let me step back. So in a spherical system, so you see what happens is that you have actually many more degrees of freedom, because every plane is remains, if you things are start doing things in a plane, then they don't move very well. Let me see this.
That's only if they don't interact with each other.
Only if they don't interact with each other. I'm trying to see. I think if you have an axis symmetric system, the most general solution is this. Axis symmetric systems. Okay. So for a spherical system, now axis symmetric, of course, L wouldn't be conserved. So for all a spherical systems, this is the most general solution.
And you only need one momentum?
Right, so I said, so that the fourth one wouldn't be independent of this. So if you want, so there are only three independent integrals of motion.
And yeah, you can just relate the moment.
You can relate all of the other ones to this. So a spherical system, this is the most general thing. I'm a bit confused about this other guy. So I think so. In general, you would think this would be the case. But it turns out that, if you have explicit dependence on Lz, that breaks a spherical symmetry, right? So for a spherical system, generically, you have F of E and L, or reduces to this. So you see, what you can have is you can have any function of E, L, and LZ. But of course, generically, if you have any function of E, L, and LZ, then your density distribution wouldn't be spherical, because this breaks symmetry. So you don't have a spherical system, right? But if you happen, you can, in principle, happen to have a system which the density is spherical, but F is not, isn't a function, has dependence on LZ. But those would be, like, in a sense, kind of fine-tuned situations where the density is a spherical symmetric, but the space-to-space distribution doesn't have a spherical symmetry. You can actually imagine things that you can design systems that are like that. One example is that if you just imagine, say, isothermal sphere, and then take all the particles that are moving clockwise around the z direction, and then reverse the direction and make them counterclockwise. So then obviously then this wouldn't be, there would be a preferred LZ, or the LZs would be positive, right? But then density distribution doesn't change, it's the same density distribution, because you're not changing the density of particles, you're just changing the direction of their rotation. So those would be kind of fine-tuned situations, right? But generically, in a spherical system, this is what happens. And the spheres are kind of weird, and I don't know if everybody did talk about resonances, right? Hello. You guys have something here at 3:30, or?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, so we're going to be at very, very soon. Okay, so this is the deal with integrable systems. I was talking about resonances. So if you have two frequencies that match with each other, then the system becomes funny, so you have a resonance, right? And in a sense, a spherical system, one of the frequencies always vanishes, because you don't have, if you start in a plane, you always remain in a plane. You can actually go through this, and so the spherical system has this type of, is a degenerate integrable system. So some of these theorems about integrable systems apply in a funny way to the spherical systems. Okay, so let me just write one last thing. So I said this is the most general thing, F of E and L. But if you just, for simplicity, assume you have F of E only, and for example, for if your system has a thermodynamic equilibrium, like the one we were discussing as a thermal sphere, F of E for constant T, what is F of E? Constant temperature. What is phase-to-space density? We have discussed this multiple times. Even today. But it's phase-to-phase density at constant temperature.
E to the minus
E over T. Good. So that would be an example, but of course that's not the only example. You could have other, any function of E would be, as we discussed, would be a solution to the Boltzmann equation. And these are interesting because we could come up with simple relationships. So you can find rho of X, which is integral of F of E d3V. So you see, the interesting thing is that, so F is generally a function of X and V, but as long as its dependence is only through energy, where E is X squared, sorry, E is V squared over 2 plus phi of X. As long as it had this particular dependence, then it's a constant. It's guaranteed to be a solution to the Boltzmann equation, a static solution. So this takes this form. It can just plug in the numbers, but from definition, is 4 pi integral of minus phi of x to 0 of e square root of 2 e minus phi of x dE. And right, so you could actually use this definition. This is equal to rho is from Poisson equation. You can plug in here. And so this is Laplacian of phi divided by 4 pi g. Or you could write it in spherical coordinates, 1 over 4 pi g, 1 over r, d by dr, dr squared of r phi. So you notice, so then phi is just the phi is the potential, it's just a function of r. And f is just a function of e. So there's a one-to-one relationship that's, so there's a one-dimensional function, it's one equation. So you can actually inverse this and invert this. And so I have to probably finish this. So let me just write the last thing. So this equation is an integral differential equation, but that can actually be solved on next. On Thursday, I'm going to write down the explicit solution. So for every phi of r, there is one f of e, and vice versa. Right? So this equation can be solved explicitly for spherical systems. And right. Sorry, what time? Which talks? Oh, yeah, the other thing. Sure, yes, that's the time in half an hour.
Okay.
Okay, good. Thank you, guys.